Zionist project only succeeded insofar as it drew upon the imperial powers of Europe and later America. To the very powers they thought they were going to escape from, they became the cat's paws of. They became the instruments of. These are the words of Joel Covell in a talk called Zionism and Its Discontents in 2007. On this day, Sunday, December 10, 2023, as Israel is in its second month of genociding, live streaming before our very eyes, before the world's very eyes, the genocide in Gaza against the Palestinians. Already tens of thousands have been killed and injured. There are still thousands under the rubble, unable to be mourned properly. Israel is unrelenting. And as Joel Covell put it, it is only succeeding insofar as it is drawing from the imperial powers. Today on the Capitalism, Nature, Socialism podcast, Dr. Joel Covell, Zionism and Its Discontents.
Is this the amplifier? Yeah, okay, yeah. Good evening, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here. Before beginning, just one slight correction, because I don't want people to come tomorrow expecting to get my other book. I have the only copy available in the Western Hemisphere. I'm not going to be in a way. It's called The Enemy of Nature. What's that? Probably with the first edition.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. This is the second edition. But if you want the first edition, feel free. But the second edition is updated. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Tonight we have another matter to talk about, although they certainly are connected, and perhaps we'll explore some of those connections as we go on. When I was asked to speak, I was asked what title should I give the talk, and the title flashed into my mind. It's one that I've never used before in discussing this topic, and I've spoken quite a bit about it since the book came out last winter. I said, well, let's call it Zionism and Its Discontents. And in doing so, I was reaching back in my own experience to a very famous text written by Sigmund Freud, which was published in 1930, called Civilization and Its Discontents. And that was a short work which influenced me considerably in my early years as a psychoanalyst, and I must have taught it about 15 or 20 times in various contexts. I practically had it memorized. I'm not going to give you an extensive critique of Freud and Civilization and Its Discontents, except to say that the more I read it, the less I liked it. Okay, and if you want to know later on why I didn't like it, I'll give you as much as you can stand on that. But for now, I just want to emphasize some of the main themes, because with Freud, as in this book, as with so many of his other works, he was profoundly wrong-headed, but also profoundly insightful, and put his mental finger on very important and fundamental issues. And the title of the book in German is the Das Unbehagen in der Kultur. Unbehagen is the word that translates in English as discontent, and it means unease. It means a difficult to define feeling of badness and wrongness. It means something that persists from within and brings down, in Freud's view, a whole civilization. Now, to put it very, very brutally simply, what Freud was saying is that in the history of humanity, in order to bring people together, they had to suppress their aggressive instincts, which were mutually destroy each other. And that's the part I don't go along with, but will not discuss further now. And in doing so, we're burdened by an increasing sense of guilt, that the more civilization proceeds, the more guilt-ridden people become. And that guilt doesn't have any rational outcome, because it's based upon inner feelings more than it is based upon what is done, and it just makes life sour, nasty, and unworthy of being a happy one. And I wanted to apply that to the subject at hand, which does interest me and should interest us all, namely the question of the state of Israel and the ideology which animates it, Zionism, which, as Mordecai most correctly points out, is a sorely undertreated subject in our world, thanks to a very, very efficient and powerful system of suppression, which the writing of this book was principally designed to challenge and itself overcome. I felt that we are deprived of a decent debate on this very, very vitally important subject in the Western world, especially in my country, the United States, but also, I do believe, in Canada as well. And being so deprived, we are unable to come to grips with it, to understand it fully, and as a result, great harm is done to many people in the world. I'll expand on that later. And even catastrophic events may unfold in the form of terrible wars. So I think it's extremely important to come to grips with this. I do not pretend that mine is the only solution. Of course, I believe it is the. I believe my analysis is the correct one. Needless to say, I wouldn't advance it otherwise. But I do not mean to impose it on anybody, only that we should hear me out and see whether it makes sense, and we should challenge it. You should challenge it if you like, and we can have an open discussion which can go on until neither of us can stand it anymore, or building must close, or whichever comes first. And but I did feel that there was something in Freud's insight, that there was a basic discontent, and that it has to do with conscience, sense of guilt, and that it leads to a sense of a pervasive malaise, which can have, however, different outcomes that pervades the history of the state of Israel. And it's a rather complex notion, this, and it has to be itself grounded historically, because it is a very, very long and intricate history that the Jewish people have undergone. I myself being one of us or them, however you want to parse it. And I would say that amongst the particular contributions of the Israelites and then the Hebrews and the Jews throughout their early years was a development of a form of society which was regulated by guilt feelings. And there are two basic ways in which human beings regulate social interchanges, and one is through shame feelings and one is through guilt feelings. That's a bit of an oversimplification. But the guilt cultures originally, I think, stemmed from this small tribe at the eastern end of the Mediterranean and became generalized through the development of Hebraic civilization, which then passed on into Christian civilization and Western civilization as a whole, so that the notion of guilt as a regulating impulse in human society is by no means generalized throughout all human societies. Most societies are shame-driven, and where prestige or honor or the like is the most the sought after mental desideratum, but that the guilt-inducing cultures of which Judaism is sort of the originator are extremely important in the development of our own civilization and important in the development of the state of Israel. And rather than go on and on about this, of course I will return to it, let me say that when I first began to write seriously on this question and to bring to before the public my views about the state of Israel, the first article I wrote, which was published in 2002, I mean, I had written other articles before him, but they were for scholarly journals. The first article in a public journal, which was in the American journal Tikkun, was called Zionism's Bad Conscience. And so what I was doing was taking Freud's insight about the guilt culture, but putting it more in the question of conscience, of the way in which we regulate our inner lives and the way in which our value systems are structured. And I felt that there was an abiding sense of badness about it. And that word bad has a number of meanings. It could mean wrong, it could mean not feeling right, it could be malfunctioning. But I thought all of those concepts applied. And that I don't think we can understand what goes on in the state of Israel and through Zionism, unless we understand that bad conscience. But of course, I'm not making this as a simple mental construction, but rather I see the bad conscience arising through certain very fundamental contradictions which cannot be overcome unless the basic assumptions of Zionism are overcome. Now, I'll just mention some examples of this, not directly, because there are no direct evidences of a bad conscience, but rather of the way in which it affects moral behavior. Okay, there's a certain pervasive set of disturbances in moral behavior. And I'll give you two quotations from a very famous leader of Israel and a Zionist, the well-known leader, Prime Minister of Israel, Golda Meir, who became Prime Minister, I believe it was 1969. And I have two quotes from Golda Meir. The first is this. Shortly before she became Prime Minister, she said, and this was in the New York Times, quote, "It was not as though there was a Palestinian people in Palestine considering itself as a Palestinian people, and we came and threw them out and took their country away from them. They did not exist. They did not exist. The very people who were displaced did not exist." The second quote, also from Golda Meir, I don't remember the year, is the following. She said, "I will never forgive the Arabs for forcing us to kill them." Wow, that's interesting, isn't it? Now, starting with that second quote, you can see it's a very bizarre statement. On the other hand, those of you who had Jewish mothers might recognize something. I mean, you certainly would not say, this has nothing to do with Jewish life, you know. I mean, that kind of this excessive focus on the notion of guilt without being able to resolve it or even name it properly, but rather turning it around and blaming others and then and wallowing in the a certain kind of pride that you are willing to look honestly at the questions of wrongdoing and that you're morally superior. All these kinds of things cluster around Jewish being. They clustered around mine. I grew up in a fairly conventional, from the outside, family in Brooklyn, born in 1936. So I was 12 years old and the State of Israel formed. And I went through the usual Jewish rituals. I was bar mitzvah, et cetera. But because of peculiarities, which I can, if you want, I'll tell you later, I had a falling away and didn't feel myself very much part of it. And over the years, became very much identified with the left. And in the course of all that, formed the following critique of Israel and Zionism. But setting that aside, I certainly recognize in my own upbringing a very constant refrain, which was, as Jewish people, we were, quote, the light unto the nations, that we were a people who lived by high ethical standards. We were people who for whom justice was the highest value and the like, that our very highest of high holidays, which we're having even as I speak, we're approaching anyway, is the atonement for sins, that we can, you know, that this is the necessary part of Jewish being and Jewish living. Now, from a psychological standpoint, what's necessary about it is that it's an element of what you would call identity, and identity means your sense of being and belonging to a group, that you define yourself through that group and through its tradition. And being that way, you're feeling yourself that you don't fully exist, that you're cast out of that group, that you don't exist as a full human being unless you follow that principle. So I just want to emphasize it's this notion of high ethical standards, of being the light unto the nations and so forth, of the essential virtue of the Jewish people is not a trivial belief, is by any means. It's a fundamental foundation, if you like, of the identity, and hence one's whole sense of belonging as a human being to a coherent tradition. Now, I hold that notion is real and persistent. On the other hand, it seems to be contradicted in real practices that have to do with tremendous transgressions that are undertaken also in the name of a notion of being Jewish. And that has to do with the origins of the State of Israel and through the ideology of Zionism. Zionism was a response taken by Jewish people in Central and Eastern Europe towards the close of the 19th century in response to a gathering sense of threat that was afflicting Western civilization as a whole. And in the context of what was undoubtedly a very uncomfortable feeling that they didn't belong in European society, that although they had come a long way since the so-called emancipations of the late Enlightenment and the early modern era of the 19th century, that nonetheless there was still no sense of belonging, and more importantly, that there was a gathering storm, that there was something terrible was about to happen. I think any sensitive observer in Europe, and you can see it written in European culture of the late 19th century, sees this gathering crisis. And the Zionism was a response to that gathering crisis by saying, we will take this feeling that we don't belong and we will master it by making for ourselves a national entity and a nation state in the lands of historic Palestine. Now, they weren't always defined that way, because sometimes the notion of forming that state could be referred to places as far as Uganda or Madagascar or the like. But it was clear that there was no real valence. There was nothing to really pull Jews towards that idea. And mind you, there weren't that many Jews who even believed in that idea at the very beginning. There was no real valence except the lands of historic Palestine. And the reason for that was that the foundation of the sense of nationhood that the Jews were undertaking was grounded in the only thing that held them together, that was common to all of them, which was their biblical origins. And this has as its corollary a very salient fact, namely that there was no actual national feeling that could unify all Jews at that time, simply because for many centuries they had lived in many countries around the world, not just after having been expelled from Rome by the conquests of the late first century, the early second century, not Rome, from Palestine, by the conquest of Rome, which destroyed the temple, but really even before then, because Jews had been scattered, you know, there had been Jews in what is now Iraq, was then, you know, Assyria, you know, Samaria, Mesopotamia. From the time of King Nebuchadnezzar in 800 before the Christian era, there were Jews in what is now Persia, from even before then. And the Jews lived in those places and saw themselves as people of those places who happened to be Jewish. The greatest Jew of the Middle Ages, Maimonides, for example, lived in Spain and then moved to what is now Alexandria, where he became the physician to the caliph there. He always considered himself a Spaniard who just happened to be Jewish. He didn't say, I'm primarily a Jewish person. I'm a Spaniard, I live in North Africa. That's how it was. So the actual national identities of Jews could not be grounded in what actually makes nationhood, namely sharing a common territory, sharing a common history around that territory, such as the Irish people developed a sense of Irish nationalism, the French people, you know, and so on, the Gaulish people. Now, this can be complicated from land to land. We needn't get into the theory of nationalism, except to say that for what the Zionists were posing was actually nationalism in reverse. That is to say, there was no nationalism to begin with, but they would create nationalism through the attainment of a territory. And the attainment of the territory could only be regulated and guided by what actually held them together, which was the biblical books of the Old Testament. And so, with all of its embedded guilt culture, which I needn't get into now for lack of time. Now, as you know, there is an extreme problem here, and was from the very beginning, because although a number of the early Zionists believed, as did Golda Meir, well, there were no people there, you know, it's just this open country, it's a land without people, for a people without land, as the saying went. That was strictly contrary to fact. There were indeed quite a few people there. They were of Arabs, they were some of Christians, many of them Muslims. They were had a complex society. They were subjects of the Ottoman Empire. They had their problems, but they were very real. And this is the key thing, in order to fulfill the nationhood, these people had to be moved aside. That was the reality. Now, you could be a Zionist and move to Israel, or not Israel then, move to Palestine. You could found a pious Hebraic settlement. You could practice your religion. There was no problem with that. They were welcome for many, many generations to do that. They would have kept being welcome. Originally, they were welcomed indeed by the Arab inhabitants of the land. Oh, it's fine because we have a common background. We're both from the Abrahamic religions and so on and so forth. There was no problem with that. There was a terrible problem, however, if you decided you want to form a nation state, okay? Because a state is an instrument of force, okay? A state does not exist unless it controls violence and makes the violence legitimate. That's the definition of Max Weber. A state is an organization that has a monopoly on legitimate violence. You know, states can kill, and that's an interesting thing. It shows the importance of conscience in human existence. All right? So the necessity of making that state happen means that you had to create violence and also a sense of legitimacy. Now, this was aggravated in the case of the Zionists because of the tremendous role that moral authenticity played in the historical and emotional and you know, collective lives of the Jewish people. Hence, they were facing a tremendous contradiction right from the start. And this contradiction led to various distortions, among which was there are no Palestinians there. So what Golda Meir was saying in 1969, fully 20 years after the formation of the State of Israel, was what some of the Zionists were saying early on. But the fact of the matter is that, of course, there were Palestinians there. They were there in great number. They vastly outnumbered the Jews. They had their own class society. They had their own tradition. They were fully formed human beings. However, in order to deal with the moral contradictions of the Zionist project, you had to somehow erase the fact that they were equivalent human beings. You could not afford to see them as human beings if you were going to take their land from them and at the same time maintain your identity as a virtuous and indeed higher civilizing force. And that matter persisted and throughout the history of Zionism. It originally was a matter of taking land by buying it through absentee landlords of the Ottoman Empire. It became eventually a question of a military confrontation after the 1920s revealed that there was going to really be an explosion. This military confrontation grew in scope and scale. I obviously can't go into the details of the history. They're available in many excellent texts, including texts written by Israelis who are interestingly much more capable of understanding this part of the history than the peoples of the United States are, for sure, and I'll explain why in a little bit. But nonetheless, there's a constant theme throughout the entire history of Israel which persists even after the acquisition of the territory of the State of Israel, and that is a theme of the expulsion, or as they sometimes say, transfer of the Palestinians. Now that's in a way impossible. Zionism is, in my view, a very bad idea. It's a bad idea for two reasons. One is because it embarks those people who believe in it on a hopeless quest to resolve contradictions, the intensity of which is only has to resolve because the quest involves increasing violence and state, you know, a terror. Indeed, and we can go into that if you like. It's also a bad idea because practically, it's totally impossible to avoid these people. I mean, when you pitch your tents in the midst of the center of the Islamic and Arabic world, where hundreds of millions of people are living there, not just the peoples in the immediate, you know, Palestinian enclaves, but the peoples in the surrounding countries, radiating out, hundreds of millions of people. You know these people are A, going to hate you, and B, are not going to be able to be forgotten. This is very different, I might say, to similar projects, because the Zionist project was not that different from other projects of what we might call settler colonialism, where settlers came and then colonized the land in which they settled. You've heard of some of these, and right? You know what I'm talking about, okay? But the settler colonial enterprises of the Americas, okay, had a very different set of problems to face. And one of the problems they didn't have to face was a very numerous indigenous people who were highly organized in the center of great empires that were going to always outnumber them. Okay, the indigenous people, the aboriginal people, the American Indians, the first peoples, whatever you want to call them, were unfortunately able to be pushed aside. They were pushed aside at a tremendous mental cost to these nation states. I speak with full authority on that. I've done a study of it myself in the history of the United States, and I know full well that people in Canada feel the same way. The costs of settler colonialism are enormous in terms of deep internal scars. And I do not say that with any satisfaction that there could be a quasi sense of relief, because at least these people could be put off on reservations and forgotten about. All I mean to say is that the Zionists had no chance of ever doing that, but rather they had to carry out their enterprises in the full view of the world, and indeed always with a search for legitimacy, because they had to postulate themselves as an advanced democratic nation in order to win any kind of approval from the world. So they were caught up from the very beginning in an utterly hopeless set of ventures. And these combined contradictions define what I call the bad conscience. Before talking a little bit more about what the bad conscience entails, let me just give you a quotation, a famous quotation from Theodor Herzl, who was the man who formalized Zionism in its political shape. In other words, there are many kinds of Zionists in the late 19th century. Herzl gave it its definitive form that led to the statehood of the State of Israel, okay, and hence called political Zionism. And in his diaries, he wrote once, he would never ever say this publicly, by the way, because he wrote once that we must, this is from 1895, this is in his diaries, we must expropriate gently the private property on the state assigned to us. We shall try to spirit the penniless population across the border by procuring employment for it in the transit countries, while denying it employment in our own country. The property owners will come over to our side. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly. Let the owners of the immovable property believe that they are cheating us, selling us things for more than they are worth, but we are not going to sell them anything back. Now, 1895, what Herzl is saying is frankly admitting to himself the necessity for a policy of what is now called ethnic cleansing. Okay? He doesn't talk about it as being violent. He says we will do it gently. In fact, that first sentence, you look in that first sentence, there are three principles embedded in it, all of which are constant principles of the history of Israel. We must expropriate, that is to say, get rid of, gently, that is to say, using fakery and trickery, the private property, that's the people, on the state assigned to us. And that's the third part we have to emphasize. Any Zionist knew from the very beginning that they were going to be much too weak to do this on their own. And although their impulses ostensibly included a desire to escape Europe with its dreadful anti-Semitism and its terrible internal conflicts that it was going to explode in the 20th century, and the horrific class warfares and the annihilations of the Nazis, et cetera, although they knew that, they wanted to get away from Europe. They wanted to leave Europe, but in leaving Europe, they had to find a land, a state that would be assigned to them by some power. And actually, it wasn't necessarily Europe at the first. Herzl spent time in Istanbul talking to the Ottomans, because he thought maybe they would assign the country to the Zionists. But the Ottomans, of course, were not interested in doing that. However, it came about, needless to say, as you should know, that Great Britain did show an interest by 1917, after a great deal of manipulation and very complex back and forth, which I don't need to go into, except to say one very important thing about it. And that is that by this time, the Western powers, of which Great Britain was the leading one, had realized that they were going to need to develop inroads into the Middle East. They were going to need the resources of the Middle East. British foreign policy was very clever, ambiguous, subtle, full of its own contradictions, but it had a very clear-sighted notion that of any, like any good imperialist, that they were going to have to control resources. And one of the most important considerations here was the fact that in 1915, Winston Churchill, then Lord of the Admiralty, had changed the British Navy from coal-burning ships to oil-burning ships, okay? British Navy is the keystone of British power, and Britain now has to start looking around for sources of oil and ways to control sources of oil. Well, they already knew that the Middle East had a lot of that, and that was one determinant and one that looms over the rest of the history of this land. So I mentioned it, I single it out from among the other massive determinants, which are very complex, but sort of secondary in their true historical significance. In this sense, okay, the Zionist project only succeeded insofar as it drew upon the imperial powers of Europe and later Americas to the very powers that they thought they were going to escape from. They became the cat's paws of. They became the instruments of, okay? That is something that has gone on throughout. And this gets me into the point I wanted to make a little earlier, which very few people quite get, and that is, why are the Zionist lobbies in the United States in particular, why is there so much more obscurantism? Why is the debate so putrid and paltry and inane in our country? Why is the media so turned away from covering this? Why is academia so cowardly on this subject, which indeed they are? Well, the answer is because Israel is totally dependent upon the United States. Totally dependent upon the United States. In Israel, Israel is just itself. And they can afford to look at what's happening. They can afford to inquire into the true conditions of the life they have wrought through the Zionist project. They can afford to see, and in fact, the Israeli internal media, not that they do anything useful with it, I don't want to go that far, but the Israeli internal media will talk freely, for instance, about the fact that this is a society with a tremendous amount of racism. They'll say, how could we as Jews, who always believed in such virtues and so on, be so racist? How could we even do things like apartheid South Africa? The notion that Israel has apartheid tendencies, okay, is one that is talked about in Israel itself. It is hellish to talk about this sort of thing in the United States for the simple reason that if in the United States, and I talk about Canada here too, but I can only really refer to the United States. And anyhow, the United States is a much more serious case of the disease that you suffer from too in this country, namely obscuring debate on this subject. If in the United States there was free and open debate on the subject of Israel and Zionism, it is very likely that there would be a serious weakening of the support of the United States government. And at that point, there would be major, major problems for the state of Israel. Because, in fact, although it's extremely powerful, third or fourth leading army in the world and so forth, it's very wealthy, it has the highest percentage of new millionaires in the last 5 years and so on, it's extremely fragile. Its power is not derived from any kind of organic relationship to a territory. It has no actual industrial base. It has no fixed boundaries. In fact, that's an odd thing about the state of Israel, you know. It never even allowed itself to postulate any boundaries because the Zionist enterprise wouldn't settle for any boundedness. It has to be the possibility of endless expansion and the like. But it has no clear, coherent boundaries. It's surrounded by hundreds of millions of people who hate it and the like. It only survives because of the prodigious amount of support from the U.S. state and civil society and civil societies throughout the Western world. Okay, and if that debate were opened, it would be catastrophic for Israel if it went badly. And if it went to make it go badly, all you need to prove is a resolution that the United Nations, in fact, had passed in the 1970s, namely that Zionism equals racism. You know, the United Nations said that, thanks to, you know, Palestinian pressure at the time. It was beaten back. The United States went crazy to beat it back. Finally, under the aegis of John Bolton, who was an ardent Zionist of the Christian persuasion, that's an important category, bear in mind, who was the ambassador to the United Nations under Bush and recently had to drop out. But Bolton has always been a great friend of Israel. In the 1990s, he managed to twist enough arms in the United Nations to actually get them to rescind this notion that Zionism equals racism. In the year 2001, there was a great big conference in Durban where the issue was raised once more, this time by peoples from around the South. And it would definitely have been passed, except that Colin Powell, the Secretary of the United States, took this seriously enough to go in, bluster, threaten, and eventually walk out of that conference and hence sort of demolish the value of that conference, because everything they passed would then not have any official certification of any sort. It could just be marginalized. If it were held that the State of Israel Zionism that animated it were in fact racist, not just psychologically racist, but structurally racist, because that racist in a way that demanded the imposition of racism on an expanding scale throughout the polity, if that were the case, it would be very, very hard to sustain the degrees of support that it has. And hence, Zionist powers, Zionist lobbies, Zionists in the U.S. government, of which there are many, 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 under the name of neoconservatives, and the like, would be deeply threatened, okay? And they're threatened anyhow, because things are going against them. And I'll terminate with that in a little bit. And I just want to emphasize to you that if that were the case, then right-thinking people who are goodwill and who believe in the standard of universal justice, people who believe that human beings have a common value by virtue of being a human being, that no human being or no human group is inherently better than any other, okay? If you believe in that, then you are led to take a very dim view of a government which mandates racism on an expanding scale. And any settler colonial state must do that, especially if it espouses high universalizing ideals. And we must remember that it came to pass that another racist state, namely South Africa, which was founded in its apartheid form in the same year that the State of Israel was founded, and the same year that the United Nations passed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, okay? That state was eventually brought before the bar of human justice, okay? And the reason was that people said it is intolerable to have a state that systematically, racistly oppresses another people within its boundaries. That is unacceptable to advanced human society. We must get beyond that. Now, in the case of Israel, sometimes it is said, well, Israel's not an apartheid state. I mean, people vote in Palestine, and we don't have that kind of Bantustan arrangement. I say, yes, that's true. It is not exactly the same as apartheid South Africa, because no two states are exactly the same. The problem in understanding human society is to find a category at the proper level of abstraction, okay, that includes the greatest number of concrete phenomena. The level of abstraction here is not whether it's apartheid or not, but whether it's state-induced racism or structural state racism, okay? If a state behaves that way, then that state should be changed. We believe that in the case of South Africa. People are very loath to even immediately to contemplate that at all in the case of the State of Israel, as we know, and that's a function, of course, of the power of the Israeli lobby, the power of the ideological forces that it can marshal, particularly very strong and residual elements of terror and deep angst stemming from the Holocaust, which was the one phenomenon that put Zionism over the top, unfortunately. But nonetheless, those are completely without legitimacy, because you cannot justify present injustice by what has been done to you in the past. That is no way to proceed. We can take that up in a discussion period if you like. But I just want to emphasize the main point here. That is to say that the relevant category is state-induced racism. If a state induces racism, it does not have the right to exist. You say, oh, why? A state doesn't have the right to exist? And I say, yes, no state has the right to exist. States do not have the right to exist. Don't you realize that? I mean, don't you realize, and I say this in the United States, if we're selling the book, I say, I'll give a free copy of the book to anybody who will tell me who said that states don't have the right to exist. You know what? Thomas Jefferson said that. That's the Declaration of Independence. That's how your government was formed, because it said that states are contracts between the people and the government, and they only have a limited right to exist so long as they fulfill human rights. And if a state is incapable of fulfilling human rights, then it should be changed. It should be transformed. I don't mean in a violent way. That's not the point. You don't have to change a state in a violent way, although sometimes that is the eventuality if the truth can't be faced, if the lesions are too strong. In the United States, the state-structured racism led to a horrific civil war, which was just one of the greatest catastrophes of modern history. I mean, you just have to study that to see how terrible, terrible it was, okay? And that's because slavery was so deeply embedded in the idea of property and in the political structures that existed. It took a war to do that, all right? But South Africa had a war, but once it was decided to liquidate the apartheid state, the liquidation went rather smoothly. Nobody had to be killed. Nobody needed to lose their life. War criminals should be punished, yes, but they don't have to be executed. If the state is decent, if it has a decent constitution, shouldn't have capital punishment, that's for sure. So there's nothing inherent in the notion that a state can be transformed nothing inherent in the transformation of a state that any great violence need be done. And indeed, I think violence will be done to the state of Israel unless people wake up and recognize the fact that this is a state that has been moving in a catastrophic direction. And in fact, people are waking up to that fact. I think that to that truth. There's a lot of interesting changes going on, a lot of things happening in the state of Israel and in Zionism that deserve to be emphasized here. It's not widely known, for instance, that fully 750,000 Israelis now choose to live outside the country. That's about 20% of the population. It's about 15% of the population. It's a lot of the population. They don't even want to live there anymore, okay? interesting survey done in the United States. It was asked, this is by a respected organization, Bronfman Trust, happened very recently. among the diaspora Jews in the United States, how many feel that the ending of the state of Israel, that its transformation from being a Jewish state to a fully democratic, open state, where everybody, every citizen had equal power, because it's not the case now. Zionism postulates a Jewish state. Jews have to rule. All Jews around the world have to have a claim to that state. Nobody who's not a Jew can have a claim to that state. They can live there maybe, but always as second or third class citizens. All right, so people in the diaspora, Jews, were asked how many would feel a personal tragedy at the thought that the state of Israel would be no more as a Jewish state. 77% of people over 65 thought they would feel it as a personal tragedy, okay? 54% of people between 35 and 50 said they would feel it as a personal tragedy. And less than 50%, I don't know the exact figure because I'm just quoting somebody who studied it, less than 50% of people under 35 said they would think of it as a personal tragedy. In other words, there has been a significant moving away from allegiance to the idea of a Jewish state as a necessary condition. I was told, somebody sent me an email the other day because one of my interviews got to another place and he said, X read your interview and he says, you think the state of Israel should be transformed? And he said, that means the end of the Jewish people. That's just the end of the Jewish people. Well, I just wrote back and said, well, please tell X he's got to get over that. You know, it does not mean the end of the Jewish people. It probably means the beginning of a new phase, the Jewish people, because I don't think anything has been worse for the Jewish people than the state of Israel. Having to defend an organization that basically functions through the criminal expropriation of another people, denies it to the world, engages in an expanding set of human rights abuses, flouts the United Nations, builds nuclear weapons in secret, refuses to sign any covenants, considers itself above the law, creates conditions in occupied territories which should never have been occupied by international law, creates conditions that are, strictly speaking, subhuman, and builds a wall to ostensibly protect itself against bombers and terrorists, in the meantime, steals another 10% of the land of the people that they've already stolen, just about everything from, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on and on and on. You just have to familiarize yourself with the debate. And on the internet, you don't have to read the big press, because they're not going to tell you, but there's tremendous resources on the internet can tell you that. And one last point, then we'll have discussion of this. The question is, well, what to do about it? Well, the official assumption is Palestinians need their state alongside the Israeli state, two-state solution. Well, here's what I want to say, another reason why I don't like the idea that Israel is an apartheid state. The reason is I think it's a sub-apartheid state. Israel is postulated on this notion, as I pointed out in Herzl, and you can validate this through any reading of the history of Zionism and of Israel. And there's a book, by the way, by a Palestinian scholar named Nur Masala, which is called The Expulsion of the Palestinians, and it just consists of hundreds of quotes from, you know, Zionist leaders from the beginning to 48, just on this subject. Since then, there's many hundreds more. The fact of the matter is that the Zionist state, the kind of racism that it expounds, is not based upon apartheid principles. The apartheid regime of South Africa built these things called Bantustans, which were reasonably compact, well-defined statelets that gave the blacks who lived there, different tribes and different, there were eight of them, a reasonable life, a completely inhuman life, because they had no true freedom, they had no power, they had no economy that was worth a damn, it was given on the worst land. But they did have reasonable security, they had schools, they had health systems, they had a sort of government. And the reason for those reasons was that the South African state was an industrial power and wanted to preserve the labor power of the blacks for working in the mines and the mills of South Africa and to keep them quiet. And so they built the apartheid Bantustan system. Now, I just want to say that the Bantustan system of South Africa, which was the foundation of apartheid, was a two-state solution or an eight-state solution. Doesn't matter. And the two-state solution that they're talking about for Palestine merely raises Israel to the level of South Africa apartheid. Okay, I say it's not apartheid now. It'll become apartheid if they have a two-state solution. Because then the Palestinians will have their little Bantustan state, their little statelet. They won't have any real power. They won't have any economy to speak of. The place has been ruined by years of predation of one form or another. And maybe they'll be able to work again in the Israeli weapons factories, which is the only major source of revenue for the youth. I don't think that's acceptable, okay? It's not possible either. The only possible thing is to think beyond the existing situation, the state of Israel. It's very hard, it's very difficult, but it's humanly worthwhile. It's a strategic goal, which some people call the single state solution, that there should be a single democratic state for all the people. It's nothing that can take place all at once. It will be very difficult, but there are many, 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 many people, organizations who are willing to undertake this. And I'll go over some of the particulars in the question and answer period, because I think I've talked enough now. It's 8 o'clock, and I would like to pause at this point and open it for questions on any and all matters that I have raised up to this point. Thank you.